Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Alan Carr's Easy Way podcast. I'm Colleen Dwyer, your podcast host and presenter of our online video programs, and I'm thrilled to have you back with us. Today, we're here to challenge societal assumptions and beliefs about addiction and offering a revolutionary approach that doesn't hinge on willpower to break free. And joining me today is Jerry Williams, who's a senior alcohol therapist in the UK. And Jerry candidly shares his experiences with drinking and his journey to quitting alcohol. And Jerry is now dedicated to helping others break free from the illusions that keep us hooked. In addition to Jerry's insights, we'll delve into the nicotine withdrawal timeline. So we're going to explore how nicotine is absorbed into the body, what withdrawal really feels like, its side effects, and its duration. And remember, we are here to address any questions you might have about addiction. And even if your question doesn't make it to a future episode, we will personally respond with detailed advice and guidance. So don't hesitate to reach out to us at pod@alancarr.com. And for a comprehensive look at the range of addictions and issues we've successfully addressed, just visit alancarr.com. But for now, just kick back, relax, and open your mind to a fresh perspective on addiction. Welcome to the Alan Carr's Easy Way podcast.
This is Addiction Central.
Addiction Central.
We want to air your success stories,
answer your questions,
and provide advice.
This advice is free of charge.
We'll answer every question we receive with no exceptions.
Contact us now
at pod@alancarr.com.
Hi, I'm Jerry, and I'm a senior Alan Carr's Easy Way therapist. I've been working in the UK now since 2018.
Hello, Jerry. Welcome to the show. I wanted to start by asking how old you were when you first started drinking.
It's a long time ago, Colleen, now. 15, 16, and my word, that's a long time ago. And, you know, it was that when you're 15, 16, you're desperate to be a grown-up. And what do grown-ups do? They drink. So I think we're all going to fall into that category. You have to have a drink. You're desperate to be an adult, so you're going to have a pint. We're going to have a drink. And I can remember the first time. It was horrible, disgusting tasting stuff. But this pressure, I think, which is quite intense when you're a 15, 16-year-old lad, to fit in. And you're going to take that drink. You're going to have that drink. And even if it tastes horrible, then you're going to keep going and keep going and keep going until you pretend that it tastes okay, I think.
So, and then what made you want to stop drinking, Jerry?
I think when we go through the seminars now, my favourite question is, how do you solve a problem that you're not aware of? And of course you can't. You're not aware of a problem, so how can you solve it? And the whole world is alongside you. Everybody's drinking. It's a bit of harmless fun. There's no problem until one day you get up and you think to yourself, right, I'm not going to have a drink today. And you end up having a drink and you think to yourself, well, when the hell did that happen? It's starting to go a little bit out of control now. I'm definitely not going to have a drink today. And you end up having a drink and you think to yourself, well, when did that happen? And it's almost you can't put your finger on that time. And at that point, then it starts to get a little bit concerning and it starts to get a bit worrying. I always thought of myself as a reasonably strong-willed individual. I'd given up cigarettes with willpower. And I know we'll make sure that we give up nothing now with Alan Carr, but I'd given up cigarettes with willpower. I started my own double glazing company, knocking doors for crying out loud, built it up to a reasonably sized company. So there's a reasonably strong-willed individual, I thought to myself, but that willpower was powerless against alcohol. And it starts then to get... What we are convinced of is having a little bit of fun and enjoying ourselves, and it helps us enjoy ourselves and it relaxes us and it does all these wonderful, wonderful things. And it's not doing those anymore, and it's starting to come along and bite you on the bum. And it's not the good fun that it used to be. And you think, right, okay, well, I'll just ease back. I'll take it easy now and I'll control it. And with me, it just got worse and worse and worse. Worse and worse and worse. And I think what also happens, you do think about this, it's my fault. It's my fault. All my friends can have a couple of pints and not get out of hand. It must be down to me. And that's also an unpleasant feeling. It's my fault. Which, of course, as Alan Carr's therapist now, we know it's nothing. It's not my fault at all. We're up against a very addictive drug. But yes, it was, and it got me bad. It got me bad. And the fact that I couldn't give up was making it worse and worse and worse. And I think, you know, when you're not drinking, you're deprived and miserable. And when you are drinking, you're guilty and miserable. So either way, the situation I was in, I was miserable. Not a good way to live your life.
And how did you come across Alan Carr's Easy Way then?
Well, a girlfriend of mine had quit smoking. She'd been trying to quit smoking for years and years and years with willpower, and went to a seminar and she just quit. Now, to me, that was quite incredible because she was a heavy smoker and had tried many, many times to quit with willpower. Couldn't do it. And then she went to one session and stopped smoking. And I was talking to her about this and said, well, how did you do it? And she couldn't explain, because I went to this one session as a smoker. I came out and I'm no longer a smoker. Why? And the logic to me didn't make sense. And she couldn't explain it. And I think that that's the usual thing. But they are also running sessions for alcohol. And that was up in London. So I was giving up, let's put it this way, I was giving up every Sunday, Colleen, and then starting every Monday. So something had to give. It was either was going to go further and further down, or I had to stop. And this lady had given up, had quit smoking, crikey, had quit smoking. It seemed very, very easily. So let's give that a go. And I came up to Raynes Park in 2014 and sat in a seminar. Walked out of that seminar and had, over 8 years ago now, Colleen, so it's just a little bit, you know, the old brain is not quite as bright as it used to be. But I walked out of that seminar and I didn't think anything had changed. And that's the very, very strange thing. But I was in a band, I played in a rock and roll band, and we had a rehearsal. That was a Sunday, the 10th of November, and we had a band rehearsal on the Monday. Went to a band rehearsal, there's always beer. Absolutely, always beer. And then we went down to the pub after that band rehearsal. I didn't have a drink at the band rehearsal. Weird. Went down to the pub after the band rehearsal. I can remember watching one of the guys pick up a pint, have a pint, and think, if I wanted one of those, I could have one. And I didn't have one. And that was the most weird. I haven't had one since. So was it difficult? No. I'd been beating myself up constantly. Why can't I give up this bloody stuff that is causing me so much grief? I walked out of that seminar, went to a band rehearsal, went to the pub and didn't have a drink. And it was the most weird, weird thing. And haven't had one since. So it wasn't difficult. It was strange. I'm an Easy Way therapist now, so I understand the method. But at that point, I had no understanding with it. It was just this absolute magic, marvellous thing that had happened to me. And I had no understanding of why. It just completely changes your thought process.
How has that impacted your life?
Yeah, because it was November, but 6-7 weeks to Christmas, you know, 8 weeks to New Year, for goodness sake. I was a serious drinker. And you can't go through Christmas and New Year without a drink, Colleen. It's impossible. It's how the hell am I going to do that? And flew through it. I went to see a good drinking buddy of mine, and we were a pair of drinkers. There's no doubt about it. We'd go around, normally I'd go around to him and he'd come around, as couples. And the first thing he'd do is take a cap off a bottle of vodka, screw the cap up, flip it over the shoulder and say, right, here we go. And that was and I went round to see him in November. After I'd been to the seminar, didn't have a drink. And fair play, you know, my friends are all thinking, well, that's, what the hell's happening to Jerry? It's impossible. This can't happen. And there is still this little bit of trepidation going up to Christmas. There's that little bit of trepidation going through to New Year. Because how can you, as a drinker, you can't go through Christmas and New Year without a drink. It's impossible. Flew through it. I don't know if that's quite the right. Because I was only 6 weeks into it, and it was in my mind, can I do this? because it's still quite, you don't quite understand what's happening to you. You don't quite understand why you're not drinking and why there's no, you're not getting up in the morning saying, I mustn't drink. You get up in the morning, you've got no desire to drink. It's the weirdest thing. But I still had to, that little bit of thought of getting through Christmas and getting through New Year. New Year's Eve, went to the golf club, and I was the driver. And the people I'm going with are in all, honestly, nearly open mouth. What the hell's going on? He's not drinking. And it was quite something. And we got through, I went on a golf jolly then in April, where, you know, we golf jollies, you go away to Spain and drink, play golf. Just one of those, you drink and you play golf. And I went and played golf and didn't have a drink. The guys I'm going on the golf jolly with, you know, is this the same bloke that we came last year with? It was, and there was nothing there. It was nothing. Right, I'm going on this golf jolly and I mustn't have a drink. There was none of that, Colleen. It's the weirdest thing. I went on that golf jolly, and it's difficult to put across sometimes in the seminars as well, because as soon as you start, right, I mustn't have a drink, willpower kicks in, doesn't it? The wife I have now said, you can have a drink when you go on the golf holiday. I don't think so. You know, I'm certainly not saying I mustn't have a drink. Everyone else out there is having a drink. Everybody. And I didn't. And that was in the April after the November, and it just, everything got better. Everything in my life got better and better and better and better from looking a little bit black, to say the least, and a little bit down, to say the least. Everything got better. The business got better. My relationships got better. Everything got better.
How about your relationships with your old drinking buddies? Did your relationships change? Did you have as much fun with them when you weren't drinking?
Couple of things on that one. I think my real friends were glad, because I was on a rocky road. We go over to this on this golf jolly. We went to Spain, and I'd actually put a deposit down on a house in Spain the previous year. My good yeah. You've got friends and acquaintances, Colleen, as you go through life. The good friends were saying, "Don't do that, Jerry, because all you're gonna find a load of expats. And all you're going to do is you're going to get, and you ain't going to be here in 5 years' time, mate. You're going to drink yourself into an early grave." So I think the real friends were quite pleased that I'd stopped. And the acquaintances then, I suppose they go by the board. But there were a couple of good friends. One wanted to know how I'd done it. You know, but how the hell have you done it? And the other one didn't want to know. Oh, I'm not listening to that rubbish. And so that was that, you know, one asked me, how did I do it? And the other just said, well, no, I'm not interested, and sort of didn't want to know. But the real friends will always be there. And I'll still see those couple of people now today. I haven't had a drink now for just over 8 years. A couple of them have died now. So I'm no spring chicken, Colleen. My friends are of the age now, and I'm not going to say that alcohol has killed them, but it certainly hasn't helped.
What then led you to think about working to help other people to get out of the alcohol trap with Alan Carr's Easy Way?
I suppose I've had a double glazing business for years and years and years, and putting plastic and glass in people's houses paid the bills, I suppose, but it's not the most worthwhile, and it was very stressful. It was. There's no doubt about it. I suppose any work is stressful, but I found it very stressful. It became a lot less stressful, believe you me, as a non-drinker. This thing that we believe does all these wonderful things for us. It de-stresses us, it relaxes us, it gives us pleasure, it gives us coping mechanisms. All these things that we believe, unfortunately, are completely opposite. And you get out of the alcohol trap and it's not quite so stressful. It's not. I can start to run this business now, and I actually turned it round. But it's not the most worthwhile thing I've ever done in my life. It paid the bills. But here I am now, not drinking, starting to think, well, hang on a minute, there must be a lot of people like me out there that are suffering. And I look back on it, suffering without a shadow of a doubt, and beating themselves up, and like, as I beat myself up, because it's my fault I've got this drinking problem. It's my fault, and I can't do anything about it. I'm desperate to give it up, and I can't. Walking out of Raines Park, those 8 and a bit years ago, the best thing I've ever done in my life. And if there are people out there that are going through the same kind of thing that I was going through, if I can be of service and help those people, then don't want to sound all sort of altruistic, but something worthwhile. If I can help someone that was in my situation, then that's worthwhile. I'm not decrying having a double glazing company, but it's something that has a little more merit, I think. As I say, not wishing to... I'm not this wonderful person that helps people. No, if I had a terrible problem, Alan Carr helped me with that terrible problem. If I can do the same thing and help other people, then I'm going to be a happy little bunny. So that was it, really. I remember the first time I got an email, and I don't know how what you want me to do, what we should do on this podcast, but I'm a 6 foot ex rugby playing, hard drinking rock and roller. And the first time I got an email, it brought a tear to my eye. That's the honest truth. Someone has emailed in and said, I can't believe how you've helped me. It's not me. I'm just a vehicle for Alan Carr. But to get that back in, and you've changed my life, and it's wonderful. It doesn't get any better than that. And I can remember that. I was with my wife in a restaurant in Poole, and it came through on the email. And it's just I don't know whether, I hate to think it's ego, I do, but there's something nice about being able to help someone else. Delivering the seminars are great fun. I'd like to hopefully that my clients think it's a bit of fun and we get the point across, maybe having a laugh and a giggle. That's hopeful. And it's a worthwhile job, Colleen, and there aren't many of those about.
And are people pretty receptive to it? I remember when I stopped drinking, Jerry, to put your hand up and say, I want to stop drinking, you were saying, I'm an alcoholic, you know, I've got a big problem. You know, there are all sorts of connotations that went with declaring that you didn't want to drink anymore.
I think, no, there's still bloody scary labels, Colleen. Problem drinker, alcoholic. These are very, very scary. And I think the brainwashing is still out there. It's still out there. That's the problem, I think, that the brainwashing. I know Alan started with cigarettes. I don't think the brainwashing is quite there, is it, with cigarettes today? I don't know. But with the alcohol, it doesn't matter what program you watch on television, what film you go and see. If you want to have a good time and you want to make that good time better, have a drink. And if you're having a bad time, have a drink. And there it is. It's across everything. And so I think the brainwashing is out there. I don't know whether the stigma is less or more. I don't know. I feel for the people that come into the seminar because I'm a problem drinker. I'm an alcoholic. These are scary labels. And I've got great respect for anyone that comes along because it takes a bit of courage to sit there and think, hang on a minute, this bit of harmless fun is not so harmless anymore. And it's my fault. I can't control this. What everybody else seems to be able to control. That I think is the main one. And I think if I can, the first thing I will say to in the start, the first half an hour of the seminar, there is no blame here. You know, there is no blame at all. We are up against an addictive drug that the whole of society thinks is a bit of harmless fun. So it's hardly surprising that we're having this conversation. It's hardly surprising you're here today to talk about this. It's a very, very addictive drug that the whole of society thinks is a bit of harmless fun. Put those two together and it's hardly surprising there is an alcohol problem.
Did you, Jerry, ever contact AA or anything?
I went to one AA session, and I look back on that. I've got a great respect for AA, but they are so totally different to Alan Carr. It's certainly, it didn't resonate with me, Colleen, let's put it that way. I walked out of there feeling worse than when I walked in. I'm not an expert on AA. And it's not my position to talk about them. But I tried once. It didn't feel right. It didn't resonate with me. It didn't. Hopefully, when people come into my seminar, they are going to be lifted. I certainly wasn't lifted when I went to my one AA session. But that's really all I can say about that. They do it a different way. It didn't resonate with me. I can remember going to my doctor. I went for an insurance medical, which sent me scurrying back to my doctor. This sylph-like 14-stone adult you're looking at now was 20 stone. I was 20 bloody stone. An absolute beer monster. And everything was wrong with me. Everything. The blood pressure through the roof. Fats and sugars in the blood through the roof. I was an absolute mess. And, I can remember lying through my teeth when the doctor asked me how much I was drinking. I was cutting it in half. I told him I was drinking 5 pints a day. And he went into apoplectic fit of 5 pints a day. That was just starters, you know. All the doctor can do is tell you to, and always remember, just keep to your 21 units. It was 21. I know it's 14 units a week now. And all the doctor can say, well, you've got to stop, mate. Well, the doctor told me, if you ain't going to make it, I was mid-40s, you're not going to make 50, buddy, if you carry on like you are. I know nothing about medicals or nothing about a doctor. I've got great respect for doctors, but I don't think they quite understand addiction. Alan Carr understands addiction, and I think what we say is we don't drink for the reasons we shouldn't. I can remember going through, I know I shouldn't be drinking, it's killing me, it's doing dreadful things to me, but it didn't stop me drinking. We don't drink for the reasons we shouldn't, we drink for the reasons we do, and until we get hold of those and understand them, then concentrating on the reasons we shouldn't is worse than useless, because even if you do give up with willpower, it's not the greatest fun. You spend every waking hour moping for something you pray you're not going to have. How much fun is that? It's even if I went months without a drink, it's not a happy month, because I want a drink. I know it's killing me, and I know it's doing all sorts of nasty things to me, but I still want to do it. There's no understanding of why I want to do it. There's no what Alan Carr gives you is the understanding of why you're doing these things that you shouldn't be doing. Addiction, what is it? That you never get enough of what you don't want. And all the time you're wanting to stop. I want to stop, I want to stop, I want to stop, I want to stop. And you just can't do it until it flips. And to me, I never met Alan Carr because it passed before I started here. But what an absolute genius when you actually flip it and you start to understand why you're drinking.
He really did understand addiction from the perspective of the addict and enabling you to change your thinking about it and free yourself was the gift he left us all, you know?
Absolute. Absolute. Yeah. And, you know, I know we call it the miracle, and I am one of those people. It is an absolute miracle. And what a guy. Once you see the truth, I think this was Alan, wasn't it? Once you see the truth, the fear of never being able to drink again is replaced by the excitement of never having to drink again. And I thought that was absolutely wonderful, because you have to, as a drinker, there are times, oh, no, I don't want to, but I've got to. I've got to have a drink today. There ain't no way I can handle all the pressures and stresses of today without a drink. You have to have that drink. It's so in you. And that is just basic addiction. How he unraveled that was, to me, genius. And then you look at it, as I say, the fear of never being able to have a drink again is replaced by the excitement of never having to drink again. Wonderful, wonderful.
You say that actually you were able to work better without drinking. So like building your business and turning things around and enjoying yourself, that actually all of those things were easier. Things that we normally associate drinking as aiding, but actually when you stop drinking, you could deal with things easier.
Absolutely. I suppose, how can we sum it up? Alcohol creates the low, and then it deceives you it's an advantage by relieving the low. That's what it does. And so it creates the low with withdrawal, and then it deceives us that it's an advantage by relieving that low which it created. So we are going through life as a drinker permanently low, but we've got no understanding of that. That next drink takes us up a bit. It relieves the low. And what we do then is we think that's a high. So yes, I've got to have a drink. I've got to have my little high. I've got to have my stress relief. I've got to have this and whatever it is. And we are absolutely hoodwinked and conned. I don't know. That's not too strong a word. We're conned into believing that we need that drink to take us a little bit higher than normal, when all it's doing is taking us, relieving that low, I suppose. And that relief of that low is pleasant. I'm not saying it's not. It's pleasant to relieve that low. But why the hell get in the low in the first place by being a drinker, I suppose? Whereas, you know, getting back to being, I also talk about, I got a lovely quote from Jim Carrey when he said, I'm very serious about no alcohol and no drugs. Life is just too beautiful. And it is. Life is just fantastic. And you've got to grab it with both hands, because my word, Colleen, 70 years of age now, and it doesn't all fly by quick, mate. It really does. And so you've got to grab it. You've got to grab this wonderful, wonderful life. And as I say, Jim Carrey, very serious about no alcohol, no drugs. Life is just too beautiful.
And especially like just remembering life. I remember I'd wake up in the mornings and just think, what was I doing last night? Who did I offend? Where have I left all my things? It was horrible because I couldn't remember it.
I've never woken up and regretted not drinking. I haven't lost my phone. I haven't lost my glasses. I haven't lost my watch. I haven't driven into a wall. I haven't fallen over and broken my nose. I haven't lost my and woken up and you get home and I've got a brand new leather jacket that's ripped and I've got no idea how it happened. Not a clue. And you think to yourself, what? This fun is now causing me incredible grief. And that's part of the problem, that we think that that fun, and the whole 90% of the adult population, for crying out loud, are doing it. And we've got no understanding. The only reason it makes us feel better, because it made us feel worse in the first place.
See, when I came along to my seminar for drinking, I had this notion that, okay, I'm a mess now. But if I could just get back to the bit where I started drinking, where I wasn't out of control and where I would just be doing it at, you know, certain functions and I wasn't blacking out and I wasn't, you know, I had this idea that that was like an ideal state for me to achieve, a holy grail, if you like, of drinking on certain occasions, but having control enough not to do it on other occasions. But now, you know, like you say, I recognise those moments were great in spite of the fact that I was drinking, as opposed to, you know, because of it. The pitcher plant, I thought, was very good at demonstrating that at no point on the journey are you in control or are you getting a benefit from it. You really are not. And the benefit belongs to the experience of being with your loved ones or the environment you're in or the achievements that you'd obtained, not from the drinking itself.
Absolutely. That there is nothing to be had. And the normal, as you say, the holy grail, the normal drinker is not getting any pleasure out of it, is not getting any benefit from it. Having said that, the normal drinker is absolutely convinced they're getting pleasure and benefit from it. Absolutely convinced. And that's what keeps us drinking, that we're sure there's a pleasure. We're sure there's a crutch. We're sure it relaxes us. We're sure it de-stresses us. Absolutely. It's not doing me any harm. I'm in control. Until one day you wake up and you're not in control. Then, and when did that happen, Colleen? That's the question. When did I lose control? When did that happen? When did I wake up and I couldn't control it? And if you look back, there's no way you can answer that question. When did you decide it would become a permanent feature of your life? When did you decide you drink every day? And there's not a drinker in the world that can answer that question, because they never did decide. It's a drug. The media doesn't help, does it? The media will not say it's alcohol and drugs. It'll never even say alcohol and other drugs. Alcohol is not a drug. It can't be a drug. Because if it was a drug, that means Carlsberg, Smirnoff are pushing a drug. So it can't be a drug. And we're allowed 14 units of this drug per week. So it can't be a drug. But it jolly well is. And it's a very potent addictive drug that's a lot more subtle. That's, I think, it's not heroin. It's not cocaine. It's very, very subtle. But it's still a drug and it still works the same way as any other drug does. I get to the other point, which I think I was going to make. That's it. As a rock guitarist, we had a three-piece band, and I would not go on stage before I'd had half a dozen pints of lager. Wouldn't do it. You're not going to get me on stage until I've had half a dozen pints of lager. And we talk about that in the seminars, don't we, about the footballer socks. I cannot play guitar until I've had half a dozen pints of lager. And that's the power of the mind is so intense. But I played sober for 5 years, and the only difference between playing sober and drunk is when you're drunk, you don't notice the bum notes. That's it. but there's nothing to do with alcohol. It's you get so up here, the illusion becomes so convincing. It's an illusion which is out of the top drawer, Colleen, isn't it? It's out of the top. It's a one. It's the illusion is awesome. It's got 90% of the adult population fooled, so it can't. It's a good illusion. It's a pretty evil illusion, but it's a bloody good one.
Yeah. Thank you so, so much, Jerry. Thank you for all the work you do and helping to bring the message to the other drinkers out there. So much, much appreciated. And your time, of course, today on the podcast.
An absolute pleasure, Colleen. And I'm very, very, very proud to be associated and a member of Alan Carr's team.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about nicotine, and I'll answer some common questions about its role in the addiction, what it feels like, and also how long it takes to get rid of it. You know, there are so many trusted sources which misinform us on a number of aspects surrounding nicotine withdrawal. So it is really important that we sort out fact from fiction. So number one, how is nicotine absorbed into the body? So nicotine can get into your body in a few different ways. If you smoke or vape, it goes through the lining of your lungs. If you sniff or chew tobacco, it gets absorbed through your nose or your mouth, and you can even absorb it through your skin. But no matter how it gets in, nicotine travels through your blood and it gets all over your body, hitting your brain pretty fast. When you smoke, it takes just 7 seconds for nicotine to reach your brain. And what is nicotine withdrawal? Okay, so nicotine withdrawal is what you experience as your body purges the poison nicotine from your system. And nicotine withdrawal isn't something that only happens when you're making a concerted effort to stop. Rather, it's something that happens every single time you put a cigarette out or a vape down. And if you were to do an internet search, like on nicotine withdrawal, you'll find most sites would describe nicotine withdrawal as including feelings of irritation, anxiety, frustration, anger, difficulty sleeping, moodiness, problems with concentration. But is that true? What does nicotine withdrawal feel like, and what are its actual side effects? Well, the physical withdrawal from nicotine is actually just a very mild, slightly empty, insecure feeling. In fact, it's so mild that most smokers don't even notice it throughout their entire smoking lives. As soon as a smoker extinguishes a cigarette, nicotine rapidly starts to leave the body and the smoker begins to experience nicotine pangs. Now, there's no physical pain in the withdrawal from nicotine. It's merely an empty, restless feeling, the feeling of something's missing, which is why actually a lot of smokers think it's something to do with their hands. And if it's prolonged, the smoker can then become nervous, insecure, agitated, lacking in confidence, and irritable. It's like a hunger for a poison, nicotine. The more obvious physical feelings that the slight feeling of withdrawal trigger are caused by the false beliefs that smoking or vaping helps you to relax, cope with stress, socialize, concentrate, and focus, enjoy drinking, or enjoy a meal. And it's these beliefs that make a smoker who's using willpower to quit experience awful panic, anxiety, upset, and irritability. If a smoker maintains that they have made a big sacrifice by quitting, and they're uncertain about whether the feelings of deprivation will ever go, then those symptoms get worse and worse, and they can affect your sleep and create a horrible feeling of doom and gloom. But the great news is the Anacar's Easy Way to Stop Smoking method ensures that the former smoker doesn't suffer any of those negative symptoms. In fact, the physical effects of quitting nicotine are entirely positive, as are the mental ones, as long as you use the right method to quit. Most smokers, even really heavy ones, don't experience so much as a nicotine headache. The stages of nicotine withdrawal cease to be a minefield or obstacle course and instead become like a walk in the park. Tobacco withdrawal, even for chain smokers or chain vapers, really isn't a problem as long as you know how to stop smoking without feeling deprived. So when does nicotine withdrawal start? Well, nicotine is a drug, and whatever method you use to take it, whether it's smoking or vaping, you will experience withdrawal. And nicotine withdrawal begins as soon as the cigarette is extinguished. Nicotine starts to withdraw from the body and the smoker can experience physical and mental symptoms. When someone has their first ever cigarette, the moment that they extinguish that cigarette, they experience the very slight feeling of nicotine withdrawal for the first time. If they light a second cigarette during the withdrawal period, the slight feeling of nicotine withdrawal is momentarily relieved and the brain concludes non-consciously, next time you feel nicotine withdrawal, do that again. The behavior of lighting a cigarette in response to experiencing nicotine withdrawal is reinforced every time a smoker lights a cigarette or has a vape, regardless of the fact that the next cigarette or vape will also be causing nicotine withdrawal. So how long does nicotine withdrawal last, and how long does it take for your body to stop craving nicotine? Well, the first thing really for us to be clear on is that the smoker's body doesn't crave for nicotine. The nicotine addict's body is just trying to purge nicotine. It's the smoker's brain that gets tricked into thinking that the next cigarette will ease nicotine withdrawal. But in terms of how long nicotine withdrawal lasts, most of the nicotine actually leaves the body over the first 3 days. After a maximum of 3 weeks, there are no traces left. And it does bear repeating that with Alan Carr's Easy Way, there is no sense of loss or feeling that you are giving up something. And as a result of recognizing this truth, that you are freeing yourself from a pointless addiction, you can actually enjoy the little nicotine pangs which occur in the first few days. They are a reminder of your freedom. Physiological withdrawal. Well, whether a smoker is in a happy situation, a concentration situation, a sad, stressed, relaxing, boring, or a lonely situation, they are simultaneously experiencing nicotine withdrawal, and they respond to that by lighting a cigarette or having a vape. And in that moment of smoking the cigarette, they immediately feel better than a moment before, and they're oblivious to the fact that the cigarette or the vape will just perpetuate nicotine withdrawal. So it's no wonder, really, that smokers are conned into thinking that nicotine helps them to be happy or to concentrate or to cope with sadness and stress and to help them relax or cope with boredom or loneliness. In reality, it's got nothing to do with genuine pleasure or genuine improvement of mood. And every time they light a cigarette in one of those situations, the brain concludes non-consciously, next time that happens, do it again. Non-smokers don't have to deal with any of the mental and physical aggravation of being addicted to nicotine. They don't suffer nicotine poisoning, nicotine withdrawal, or the unnatural impact nicotine has on dopamine and their behaviour. Reducing nicotine withdrawal. All a smoker or vapor is trying to achieve when they light a cigarette or have a vape is to recapture the feeling of peace, calm, tranquility, and completeness they enjoyed their entire lives before they lit their first experimental cigarette or vaped for the first time. In other words, a smoker smokes in order to feel like a non-smoker, and a vapor vapes in order to feel like a non-vapor. Once a nicotine addict understands Alan Carr's Easy Way, we explain how nicotine addiction, irrespective of nicotine's influence on dopamine levels, is actually extremely mild, and that the really unpleasant symptoms a nicotine addict suffers when they try to quit without Easy Way's help are the result of a mental struggle. That struggle or craving is caused by the nicotine addict feeling deprived of what they think is a genuine pleasure or crutch. Easy Way goes on to reveal how the nicotine addict's belief system surrounding the drug, that it helps them to relax and socialize and handle stress and concentrate and enjoy alcohol and take a break from work and so on, is illusory and based on misinformation, misinterpretation of personal experiences, and their addiction to nicotine. The smoker then concludes that there aren't any factual advantages or benefits to be obtained from nicotine, and therefore there is no point in doing it. This effectively destroys the belief that they need the drug, and that simultaneously removes the want to smoke or vape, which ends the addiction. This leaves the smoker to handle the extremely mild symptoms of nicotine withdrawal without having to experience the discomfort of feeling that they're missing out on something that they used to enjoy or receive a benefit from. And this is so important, as the former smoker develops new responses to any habitual triggers to smoke over the first few weeks of being a happy non-smoker. For example, if they used to light a cigarette as they left work in the afternoon, that might be a moment when the thought of smoking crosses their mind. But once they quit with Easy Way, instead of consciously processing thoughts and feelings of loss, they process thoughts and feelings of release and freedom. Smoking and nicotine withdrawal timeline. Many people believe that nicotine withdrawal is difficult and unpleasant, and that there will be nicotine headaches and clear signs of nicotine withdrawal, such as mood swings and difficulty concentrating and anxiety. This belief would create a tremendous fear of quitting smoking and vaping for anyone, but withdrawal is not as bad as people fear. You may be surprised that nicotine addiction is 1% physical and 99% mental. The reality is that smokers go into withdrawal whenever they put out a cigarette. Smokers sleep through physical nicotine withdrawal every night when they go to sleep, but it's so mild, it doesn't even wake them up. It is the mental reaction that causes the physical feelings. The notion that smoking or vaping helps to enjoy drinking or enjoying a meal, it's these beliefs that has a smoker who's using willpower to quit experience awful panic anxiety, upset, and irritability. It's the notion that smoking helps the person to relax, cope with stress, socialize, concentrate, and focus. It's these beliefs that has a smoker who's using willpower to quit experience awful panic, anxiety, upset, and irritability. As a smoker goes through the various stages of quitting smoking using willpower, the symptoms get worse and worse and include everything I've just mentioned, as well as sleeplessness and a general feeling of doom and gloom. And the great news is that Anacar's Easy Way method ensures that the former smoker doesn't suffer any of those negative signs of nicotine withdrawal. In fact, the physical effects of quitting nicotine are entirely positive, as are the mental ones, as long as you use the right method to quit. So when do nicotine withdrawal symptoms stop? Well, nicotine withdrawal, which is, again, I'll just repeat it, a very mild, slightly empty, insecure feeling, so mild you sleep through it every night, it starts the moment you put the vape down or the cigarette out. And within 30 minutes, you are 50% nicotine free. Within 8 hours, you are 97% nicotine free. And within 3 days, you are 100% nicotine free. When do nicotine withdrawal mental symptoms stop? Well, immediately, pretty much. I mean, as soon as you recognize it, you're not making any kind of a sacrifice. With the willpower method, that feeling of loss and deprivation can actually increase. And for some people, they have to carry it with them their entire life. So to overcome your fear of withdrawal, you need the facts, not the fiction. And you can get the facts about nicotine withdrawal. And trust us, you'll be pleasantly surprised. And you can quit easily with Alan Carr's Easy Way. Thanks again for listening. Please do like and subscribe. And I look forward to our next episode.